Hi, I'm Perry, and you're listening to The Beauty Brains. Hello, and welcome to The Beauty Brains, a show where real cosmetic chemists answer your beauty product questions and give you an insider's look at the cosmetic industry. This is episode 233. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, and with me today is Valerie George. Hey, Valerie.
Hi, Perry.
Episode 233, can you believe it?
That is so awesome. I think this is our 58th episode together.
That is a good point. We are the longest running.
Is that right? Did I do that math right? Yeah,
well,
I think I did.
166 plus 56. Yeah, 57. There you go.
No, 57. I think that's 67.
Oh, well.
We weren't math majors, everyone.
This is not the math brains. We are the beauty brains, apparently.
Oh, boy.
All right, Valerie, you know what we got on today's show?
What do we have?
We've got questions about a couple of ingredient questions. We're going to find out whether rosehip oil is good to use and why does it oxidize so quickly. We're going to talk about Redken Extreme Bleach Recovery Lamellar Water and whether it's good for platinum hair. We're going to talk to you about the difference between fractionated coconut oil and other ingredients they might slip in. And finally, we're going to answer that ever wondering question, do hair oils clog the scalp? And of course, we'll get to some beauty science news. But first, a little chit-chat. Hey, are all the fires out there in California?
Finally, the skies have cleared. The air is less smoky. The bad air warnings have been taken off of our iPhones.
Oh, that's wonderful. How's the pandemic treating you guys out there?
You know, it's about the same for me. You know, we've been back to work since May. So it's just kind of normal. I go to work wearing a mask, interact with people wearing a mask. Our testing salon did get to open back up. So I'm very, very excited about that to get all of our guests in and test all the cool new hair color that I'm working on.
Now, when people go there, do they have to get their temperature taken or just wearing a mask and you guys just kind of figure it's okay?
Nope, we do all of the COVID symptoms, and even as employees, we have to do that before we can come into work. You know, we do the, you know, have you been in contact? You know, even though it's like, hey, I saw you yesterday, and then you get your temperature checked. It's kind of funny. I can, I play a game where I write my temperature down, and then I take it to see how right I am, and then obviously if it's wrong, I change it. But it's kind of
a fun
game.
Do you use that does sound like a fun game, and I would love to play it. Do you use the laser beam temperature things, or do you guys have thermometers?
We use, the things that you just hit on your forehead with the laser.
We used to use that when, in production, we would use that to take the temperature of a large batch, right?
Yeah, we have like a big one that we use for production. Yeah, that's kind of fun.
So you don't shoot this giant laser at people's heads.
Sometimes I catch people using it in the lab, and I'm like, hi, use a thermometer. Like, that's insane. It's way more work to hold this gun to your batch than it is to just like pop a thermometer in it.
I know, just put it in there. Oh my God.
I just think people like using it.
I gotta admit, when I was in the claims group, we used that temperature thing all the time. I just loved it. It was so much fun. Zap. Hey, you know what I did yesterday?
What'd you do?
Well, I had this goal to run 125 miles, and I was 12 miles short. But every August, I always run my castle run, and I hadn't run it, so...
Wait a second, like 125 miles in one sitting or a week or...
No, the entire month, 125.
Oh, okay. I was like, I didn't know you were an ultra man.
No, well, I have done a 50 miler.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it took me 8 hours and 23 minutes, and that got me in the Guinness Book of World Records for the fastest 50 miles done while juggling. True story. It has since been eclipsed.
That's why
it has
I'm
been
laughing.
Eclipsed by some young punk startup. But nobody's ever done the 100 miler. I'm working on that one.
Anyway, so you're at this castle.
No. I do the castle run where I run in the shape of a castle for whatever it was, 12 or 13 miles. And I end up at White Castle and then I eat a bunch of White Castles.
Oh my gosh. Is this a sanctioned run or is this kind of like your own thing?
It's my own thing. I do it once a year in August, the old Castle Run. And it was yesterday.
Oh my gosh.
It's a lot of fun.
I love it. Oh man.
You know, you've got to do stuff in life to keep yourself amused.
It's interesting, and it's tradition, and nothing's better than tradition.
I know. I've done it like 7 years in a row. I gotta keep it going.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds fun. I wouldn't go to White Castle. I would probably go to Taco Bell, and I would have to run in the shape of a bell. Is that how it works?
Bell run. Yeah.
Or
the bell
the shape
run,
of
yeah.
a taco.
I would go with the shape of the bell, right?
All right.
Although that is kind of a taco shape, so it really depends. Speaking of taco shapes, why don't we do beauty science news?
I don't think those have anything to do with each other, but... What'd you see this week?
Well, you know what's on my mind? Lots of animal testing. Mm-hmm. I saw a few stories about animal testing in the news, and there's some misleading stuff out there, I have to say. So the first thing I saw was the Daily Mail. Are you familiar with the Daily Mail?
That's where I get all my British royal news and other, celebrity news when I'm laying in bed at night.
Well, it turns out the Daily Mail is not exactly always accurate.
No way. Really?
Yeah, they said that there's a new EU rule that says cosmetics must be tested on animals, despite the law in the EU that says testing is illegal. So,
not surprised they got it wrong.
Yeah, so they do this whole article saying that companies like Dove, The Body Shop, L'Oreal are all going to have to start doing animal testing if they want to sell their products in the UK.
Did we call the Daily Mail a newspaper or a tabloid?
I'm going to say it's a tabloid.
I don't
think
we mentioned it, but yeah, at this point I'm like, yeah it's a tabloid.
Well, you read it and there was this ruling. And the thing is, if you want to find out what's reality, then you've got to dig a little bit deeper. And it turns out that no, in fact, the EU ban on animal testing is still in effect for cosmetics. It has been since 2013. This was a new ruling which was related to ingredients that are used with other industries. And it was related to how you have to do animal testing to ensure the safety of workers. But rest assured that in the EU, animal testing continues to be banned for cosmetics, despite what the Daily Mail has to say about it.
Yeah, it's interesting because we have these cosmetic regulations that say, no, you can't do this, or yes, you have to do that. But then you also have these other regulations in place for other industries, like the ingredient aspect of the industry, or even REACH, which is the chemical regulation in Europe. They sometimes say animal testing has to be done.
Yeah.
So if people animal test for REACH because there's other industries and that ingredient's also used in cosmetics, it's disqualified. Like, it's really, it's so conflicting.
Well, I have to say that while the EU does ban animal testing, there is sort of that get around, because if it's used in if the ingredients used in pharmaceuticals and cosmetics, mm-hmm. They'll do animal testing with the pharmaceutical stuff, and then it'll still apply to the cosmetics. So there.
Yeah, because they'll say, well, we didn't do it for cosmetic purposes, which is what the law states.
Right, yeah. Right. And so there, it is a bit of an exaggeration. The I know the animal testing ban makes people feel good, but it's not exactly as banny as people might seem, right?
Also, if a raw material supplier has to animal test it, maybe let's say for the Chinese market, they'll just change the trade name of the raw material and say, oh, well, we never tested this raw material on animals. And it's like, well, that's the letter of the law, but it's not necessarily the spirit of the law.
Yeah, I have to say that these brands that are claiming cruelty free, I am a little bit cynical of that, because animal, as I probably said before on the show, cruelty free is not really free from cruelty. It just means that they haven't personally animal tested the ingredients. Mm-hmm. The ingredients mm-hmm. were undoubtedly tested previously on animals by some other company. Now they just inherited that. So they're just not doing any new animal testing. And that doesn't really count the, if it's a plant-based ingredient, that doesn't count like the bunnies and the mice that were ground up during the harvesting. So it's hardly cruelty-free anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
There was just one other thing on the animal testing front that sort of made the news today. It turns out China has updated their rules, so apparently cosmetics don't need to be tested on animals to be sold in China. One of the problems that companies have had, especially big companies who wanted to get into the China market, is that China does require, or at least has required, animal testing on cosmetics. And a lot of companies have taken heat, especially big companies, L'Oreal, P&G, Unilever, because they want to, of course, sell into China. But recently, China has finalized some animal testing regulation, and they're saying that the era of cosmetic animal testing is nearly at an end. China is set to revise their animal testing policy, which means that beauty brands trying to get into the Chinese market can bypass animal testing. So they don't have to do animal testing when this comes into effect, which I think will not be until next January. But it's coming up.
Yeah, it's a bit away, and it's not as clean cut as that. If you are interested in this topic, I highly recommend you dig into some research on it from regulatory experts who can decipher it for you. I think there are some instances where animal testing still may be required. There's a lot of pieces that go with this regulation. So expect more to come about it in the news as it's decoded. And okay, here's what it really means. And of course, it does not go into effect for a tiny bit of time. So we'll see some more stuff unfolding, especially as, you know, people rush to get into the Chinese market and then they realize their ingredients aren't in the Inky dictionary that China has. And it's a little bit more complex. This article makes it seem pretty simplistic.
Yeah, so they're making progress on banning animal testing in China. It's still not banned in the United States, but admittedly, most companies don't do animal testing now just because, you know, it's expensive. Cosmetic companies don't actually want to do it, and a lot of companies make it part of their brand ethos that they're better than everyone else because they don't test on animals, even though they use ingredients that were already tested on animals, but they didn't do it personally.
A long time ago by someone else. Yeah. Well, we were sent an Instagram post by one of our followers, Mary, and it was from an account about functional foods. That'll give you a clue what the name of the account.
Uh-oh. Go ahead. Okay. Functional foods, yeah. Sure.
Yeah, and they have a big following, and they made a post about 20 ingredients to avoid in personal care.
Oh, this sounds like it's going to be helpful.
Yeah. Well, I was a little disappointed because OBS, they quoted two of the most annoying, inaccurate organizations to rate your products, EWG and Think Dirty. They, of course, state that the ingredients in their list could be impacting your health. Warning, watch out, your cosmetics are not killing you. Anyway, that's my quote, not theirs. And of course, they couldn't help but mention what little oversight there is from the FDA. They did mention the pesky problem of counterfeits coming in from Asia, which is a true problem, but they incorrectly state that they've been tested to contain bacteria. I'm not aware of any microbial contamination being an issue with counterfeits. Really, the big issue is all the other stuff in there, which they do mention, feces and other hazardous compounds. To my knowledge, though, the biggest issue is these products, these counterfeit products or even just products from Asia usually contain mercury or asbestos. Yeah. And that's personally what I would have led with in that post,
sure.
Not bacteria.
Bacteria and feces sounds much crazier.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie to you. It's a little hard to detect feces in cosmetic products.
I don't know how you could.
I'm not aware of a method or standard for that. But anyway, of course, the list had all the usual things, you know, sulfates, parabens, silicones, PEG compounds, propylene glycol. They annoyingly put on the list aluminum hydroxide, which is an antacid if you have stomach issues. I think they meant aluminum salts, like in antiperspirants. Of course, they just generically stated alcohols. They didn't do any explaining, like what about cetyl alcohol?
Oh, yeah.
Versus isopropyl alcohol versus, yeah, right? So clearly this list was created using the internet, using their fabulous University of Google diplomas, and obviously was not done by someone skilled in the sciences, the cosmetics industry, or toxicology.
And no chemists were consulted, obviously.
Oh, yeah. However, they did have one interesting item on their list that I've actually never seen before on a void list.
Oh, really?
I was a little surprised. Yeah. Rancid oils.
Rancid oils? Hey, that's going to tie into one of our questions, isn't it?
Yeah. Have you ever seen that on a no-no list?
I have not seen that. No. Rancid oils.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting because they have a valid point, but also like an invalid point. And I'll save some of it for the question that we're going to get into today.
Yeah.
But I found it surprising because you actually can't tell as a consumer other than smelling the product if the product has a rancid oil. Like you would never know. If the product would have to be a pure oil,
right,
first of all, and you would have to be familiar with the olfactive profile. And most people are not performing the compulsory oxidation tests that you would check for in an oil.
Right. I mean, maybe the color would change too, right?
Yeah, but it would have to be like a pure oil, right? Like if I made a conditioner and I put tons of rancid oil in it, you're probably not going to know.
No. Yeah, probably not.
Yeah.
But if
no one's writing, hey, we use this rancid oil in the product. But you could take a guess by looking at the type of oil in the product,
right,
whether or not it's rancid.
Right.
I will say that. But yeah, that was kind of an interesting ad on there. Stupid list.
Yeah, that is new. I think we should let people know that lists like ingredients to avoid are almost always just poppycock, and it's not really in the consumer's interest or in your interest to avoid ingredients like wholesale unless you're allergic to them and you have a known allergen. But just taking a list like that and saying, oh, I'm avoiding all of these, it's not usually a good strategy. It's not going to increase the safety of your products. And it just makes you worry more about your ingredients. And you don't really have to worry that much.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Since we've already brought up the rancid oils, why don't we move into the beauty product questions?
Yeah.
Hello, Valerie and Perry. I noticed on a previous show, Valerie briefly touched on rosehip oil and how it oxidizes quickly. This got me curious about other facial oils and their rate of oxidation, if you will. What are the best lasting oils to buy, if any? Squalane, argan, jojoba oil, you gotta tell us. Also, if the oils, or any products in general, oxidize, will this cause damage to the skin?
Clara, thank you so much for the great question. And I do want to apologize because Clara is actually a very long time dedicated listener.
She is dedicated.
Of our show. Yeah. She has attended our previous Instagram lives that we've done, which by the way, we should do.
I know. Remember when we used to do
soon.
Those? Yeah. We should do another one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, so she had asked the question in a live and we said, oh, we'll get to it after the show. She wrote us on our Instagram, but I don't know, but you Instagram DMs are kind of hard to keep up with sometimes. And especially if you read one and don't respond, and then it just gets lost. So, Clara, we are very sorry, but your persistence has paid off because you sent in...
Yeah, we love the audio question, sure.
Yeah. So, lickety-split, you're on the show. So, anyway, Clara, please forgive us, and let's answer your long-awaited question.
Yeah, rosehip oil, rose cana fruit oil, your rose cana flower oil, lots of names for this ingredient.
Yeah, so there are a lot of oils going back to, you know, that nasty list that I read. A lot of oils are not shelf stable. And I'm not just talking once they're in the bottle and you buy the product and you take it home and use it. Once an oil is produced by a harvester or processor, if they're not internally stabilized with something, and even if they're internally stabilized with something, they start to oxidize very quickly. And it can happen with heat. It can happen with air exposure. These oils are often not packed in a vacuum. So once they're processed and in the drum, they start to age. And some oils are very oxidatively stable. That's the terminology that we use. And other oils go very quickly. With argan oil, I could never figure out why people were so, you know, go hung for it, because it's actually very poorly oxidatively stable. It has a shelf life of about 6 months. There's a very good journal article. I believe it was published in 2013 about the oxidative stability of argan oil.
I think it was because people saw those goats or sheep that would get up into the trees and eat the Moroccan oil.
No, isn't that how like coffee was discovered?
No.
I think that's how coffee was discovered. The goats eat the coffee beans.
I think the Moroccan oil or the argan oil is same deal.
Well, I heard an ingredient supplier had a ton of it, and they were like, let me spin the story of this oil. That's what I heard.
Well, anyway. they were good storytellers, because that stuff was hot for a while.
Yeah. There was actually an aside about argan oil. There was an interesting graphic I saw one time about the number of launches with argan oil products over the years. And one year it was like 11 products launch. And then the next year it was like 33,000 or like something stupid like that. Whoa. Okay. We're getting off.
I know.
We're getting off track.
This isn't rosehip oil. Hey, and incidentally.
Yeah.
Do you know where rosehip oil comes from?
No, where does it come from?
Well, it turns out that it's produced in northeastern Portugal and in a lot of regions in Turkey.
I knew the Turkey piece. Interesting.
Sure, yeah. There you go.
Okay.
Tell us about rosehip oil, though. Is it going to go rancid?
Yes.
Oh.
Eventually.
Uh-oh.
All oils will go rancid eventually. Just a matter of when, right?
Sure. So, entropy. It's the second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah, so all oils are composed of fatty acids with varying carbon chain lengths. And not only just varying carbon chain lengths, some of them have all single bonds, they're fully saturated. Some of them have a double bond. Some have many double bonds. And in the case of an oil like rosehip oil, it's considered a polyunsaturated oil. And it has many, many double bonds within the oil. And those double bonds react. They oxidize. And
actually, like over 50% of it, almost 60% of it is linoleic or linolenic acid, which has, it's a C18 and it has double bonds in between it.
Yeah. And it will just go. Yeah. If it's, especially more quickly, if it's not stored properly, or you have no idea how long it's taken until it got to you.
Exposed to air. And yeah.
Yeah. There are a couple suppliers of oils and butters that have an internal stabilizing process that can increase the shelf life. And of course they refine them. But if you're using like a cold pressed oil, it can go pretty quickly. If you are looking for some more stable oils, people always say that jojoba oil is one of the most stable oils you can find. Of course, because it's not actually an oil. It's a liquid wax.
There you go.
So it's not actually an oil from a chemistry perspective at all. Clara, I know you asked about squalene. Squalene is actually very oxidatively unstable. In fact, we actually don't use squalene. We use squalane, which is the fully saturated version with an A at the end, not an E.
Right. The ene, when you're naming organic compounds, when it has a ene at the end, it means it has double bonds in it.
Yeah, that's a very good trick to help people remember. Yeah. And then, of course, I personally like marula oil. I've done a lot of analytical testing of marula oil and have found that a lot of cold-pressed marula oil is super high in oleic acid, which just has one double bond, pretty stable. I've seen certain cold-pressed marula oils be oxidatively stable for 4 years. Not kidding.
Oh, 4 years. Wow.
Yeah. I know that you once mentioned watermelon seed oil is one of your favorites. I've read mixed readings about it, because watermelon oil does have some linoleic acid in there that is dominant fatty acid is highly unsaturated, but it actually does have some decent shelf stability. Watermelon seed oil, which is like a super hot oil right now, especially if you like Glow Recipe. Love their products.
Wow. Well, I do like watermelons anyway.
Yeah. And then your next question, okay, so let's say your oil's oxidized. Really, what's the big deal? And we've talked before that most consumers probably won't notice a benefit from the different fatty acid profiles in oils. It's probably a very, very small difference on skin and hair. But I feel like sometimes, I mean, at least me, I do, oils is one of my favorite topics in the world. I feel depending on how the oil is extracted, you can feel some differences, but I don't know how many consumers notice a difference. And of course, when you get into oils with very similar fatty acid profiles, it can be difficult to distinguish them from a performance perspective.
Yeah.
Typically, the biggest things are how lubricious or how heavy the oil is where you see the difference. Now, if the oil's rancid, it's not necessarily bad for you. I know a lot of people say, well, you have all these free radicals being generated. Would I use an oil in a rinse-off product if it were rancid? Sure. Yeah. On a leave-on product, I probably would not. And there actually aren't very many studies that show that there's negative impacts on your skin. And I couldn't find any really valid ones. But I think the biggest thing is when you are using like a fully oil-based product and it's rancid, the smell is very terrible.
It doesn't even take that much of a rancid oil for your nose to pick up that scent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it's not going to hurt your skin very much or in any way that we know of, but it might smell kind of, you might notice it, even a small amount. So I wouldn't recommend it in a leave-in, but rinse off, it should be perfectly fine.
Yeah. And so continue to buy the oils that you love if you love the performance of them. I would store them properly. I wouldn't leave them in a humid or hot place. I wouldn't leave them open. I would store them as tight as possible. And I would buy small quantities because unless you're going to use it quickly, it's going to sit around. You're going to keep opening and closing it.
Yeah.
So buy as little quantities as you can. And even buy from a source that is being transparent about the age of the oil. I don't know anyone that's doing that. When I sell oils, I will certainly do that because I think it's incredibly important. I have a business opening later this year. I'll tell you guys about it.
Yay.
Yeah, but as long as you love the oil, keep using it. And when it starts to smell, you know it's past your time, past its time, and you can safely dispose of it.
Indeed. All right. Shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah, what do we got?
Well, our next one comes to us from one of our patrons. Thank you so much, Erica, on Patreon. And
thanks,
if you
want to
get if you want to get bumped up to the front of the line for questions, you know, we take our Patreons patrons first. You can go to patreon.com/thebeautybrains and subscribe. Okay, here's
Patreons
what Erica had.
Patreons first, audio second.
Indeed.
Instagram, you know, when we can, we'll try very hard. But at least Clara didn't ask a question about a product that got discontinued like poor Frank did with the caffeine and the under eye cream by the time we got to it.
Well, there you go. Still a good question. All right. Erica says, I noticed a new product by Redken geared towards repairing bleached and damaged hair called Extreme Bleach Recovery Lamellar Water Treatment. Boy, ooh, these marketing people really have... they really grabbed on to that lamellar stuff, haven't they?
They're very good, yeah.
Anyway, their claim is as follows. Moisturizes dry, brittle hair to restore softness, smoothness, and shine, conditions all hair types and textures, and restores the feel of healthy hair. Liquid warming texture instantly penetrates hair cuticle to fill porosity. And great for ultra-sensitive hair from highlighting services. And then she goes on and lists the ingredients, which is an interesting ingredient list because the first ingredient is not water. It's propylene glycol, which we're going to come to that in a moment. Then she says, since I love my platinum hair and have no intentions of stopping, will this be a good addition to my hair care regimen? Thank you.
Well, before we answer the question, Erica, I know you have no intention of stopping, but just know in case you come up to the signs where you should stop, when your hair is breaking off and all that kind of stuff. But in the meantime, enjoy it and take good care of it.
Because platinum blonding is pretty damaging to hair, huh?
Oh, yeah. Your platinum is, in hair color, you have like level 1, which is black, and level 10, which is really light blonde. Platinum mm-hmm. is beyond that. So almost all of the pigment is taken out of the hair, and then you tone it to completely neutralize it. It's a really stunning look. And I wish I could do it. I could probably never go platinum. I'm too dark. If I wanted to have any hair left.
So this one goes to 11. Is that what we're saying?
11 or 12, and good for her if she can do it. And I'm very happy. I'll live through you, Erica.
Well, Erica, whenever I evaluate a product, the first thing I like to do, surprisingly, not looking at the ingredient list, but I like to look at the claims, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because you can tell a lot about whether a product is going to be something special or not just by reading the claims. I mean, if they make really unique claims, that's a bit redundant. How do you qualify unique? So sorry. So anyway, if they just make unique claims, then you might have some sort of unique product or unique technology. So let's look at these claims that were said. First was the one, it moisturizes dry, brittle hair to restore softness, smoothness, and shine. Valerie, have you ever heard of a claim like that?
Oh, gosh. Every day.
Every conditioner.
It's not hard
says
to substantiate.
That, right?
Yeah. No, pretty much every conditioner. Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing in this claim that says, oh, this is a special product. Next claim was, it conditions all hair types and textures and restores the feel of healthy hair. Again, this is just a standard conditioner claim, right? I
mean, do you know how to test for that, Perry, to substantiate that?
The conditions and restore healthy feel? I mean, we would do like a panel test, right?
Yeah, but the trick is all hair types and textures. You feel like, oh my gosh, I could use this product. It's for me. And what you have to do is just test it on many hair types and textures and have them say, oh my gosh, the feel of my hair feels restored. It feels healthy. And boom, you have a claim.
And another way you could do that is you have hair tresses, mm-hmm. which are different textures. And then you have a panel of people feel the different tresses, and then they say that. But yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that would work with this product, but it would also work with just any hair conditioner, right? Next one. The liquid warming texture instantly penetrates hair cuticle to fill porosity. Now, the warming part is actually kind of interesting, and that's when you have to take a look at the ingredient list. And indeed, if you look at the first ingredient, is propylene glycol, and next is denatured alcohol, and then water is like down to the fourth one. But that is really the thing that's causing that warming effect. If you have low water and you have a high level of humectant, when you strike it with more water, that is going to lead to an exothermic reaction. Exothermic just means it heats up, and then you get that special effect.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
But it's very cool, but that's all it is. It's a special effect.
Yes, that is true. But when people feel that change, they're like, wow, something is happening. And they're right. Something is happening. Is it something meaningful? Meh.
Yeah,
but it's psychological, and that's right. A lot of what products are.
Exactly. Part of the experience. And so it's kind of a cool thing because most products don't do that. It's not going to have any difference with your hair, though. And then finally, it says, great for ultra-sensitive hair from highlighting services, which is rather a generic claim than I think anybody could make about a product to say, oh, this product's great for your hair. Yeah, everybody says that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, based on these claims, I wouldn't expect this to do anything really special to your hair. It might be a special experience because it's going to heat up when you feel it. But it's pretty much a standard silicone-free conditioner. It's got behene trimonium chloride, citrimonium chloride in it, and then some humectants in it. I hope you didn't pay a lot for this. That's all I have to say. Brings us to our next question.
This question comes to us from Grand Champ Greco. Hi, guys. So fishing around on Craigslist, I purchased a few gallons of an ingredient that the seller said was fractionated coconut oil.
Uh-oh.
This is the first ingredient buy I've ever seen on Craigslist. Okay, but anyway. Grand Champ Greco would like to know, how do I know the difference if it's liquid paraffin oil or mineral oil?
Oh, my.
First, everybody, do not buy your ingredients on Craigslist unless it's a business, a reputable seller. Don't buy them on eBay. Try not to buy them on Amazon. There is virtually little control over knowing the supply chain of that raw material unless they're willing to supply documentation with it. Typically, when you buy an ingredient, you get something called a certificate of analysis, and it identifies what the ingredient is. It identifies what all of the chemical, physical, and other organoleptic properties are. And you look at this piece of paper and you say, okay, it has all of these specifications. And then you look at the raw material and say, does it match these specifications?
And the specifications are just numbers that relate to specific characteristics, like maybe pH, maybe viscosity, color, odor, those sorts of things.
Yeah. And if they don't match, it doesn't mean it's not that ingredient. It just means it's out of specification. One of the other things that we do is we just don't look at a certificate of analysis. We actually do the comparison testing, and we take it even a step further in the lab, and we look at the ingredient on an infrared spectrometer. We call it IR analysis.
Sure.
And essentially, this is a device that essentially takes a chemical fingerprint of a molecule. So let's say I bought vitamin C before, okay?
Yeah.
I have a known supplier. I bought vitamin C. I would create a standard on my IR, which takes the fingerprint. Everyone has a unique fingerprint. And when I get another batch of vitamin C, I scan that one on IR and I compare the two and say, are the fingerprints the same? They should be. And if they're not, if I get different peaks that are not present in the standard, but they're present in the sample, I know that the material is either contaminated or it's the wrong material, which actually, believe it or not, happens sometimes. Ingredient suppliers make mistakes. They put the wrong label on something and ship it out or whatever. Now, if you're just you and you're getting your ingredients from Craigslist, you probably don't have an IR. I'm going to take that guess.
Yeah, that's a good guess. That's a good guess.
Yeah, we're not mathletes, but I know that for sure. We could probably make that educated guess. So,
you know, Valerie, in high school, I was a mathlete.
Which I would not admit that since we...
I'm going to cut that out of the show. I kicked some butt in geometry, let me tell you.
I used to try to make my own theorems in geometry. I was almost a math major.
Oh,
which,
well, there you go.
Yeah, which is pretty embarrassing. But anyway, well, it's late at night.
It is, indeed.
We'll just leave it at that, yeah. So anyway, you know, honestly, Grand Champ Greco, it's hard to say if what you got is actually fractionated coconut oil unless they provided some documentation. Now, fractionated coconut oil is very different from liquid paraffin oil or mineral oil. Maybe not in appearance. I mean, maybe the viscosity is slightly different. It would be tough to tell.
It's so the fractionated coconut oil is essentially coconut oil with the with some of the longer chain fatty acids taken out of it.
And right, so you're left with small and medium chain fractions.
Exactly.
So it's very liquidy. Mm-hmm.
And paraffin oil and mineral oil, those are actually long chains. So if you're comparing them, like fractionated coconut oil has C8s and C10s, whereas mineral oil may have C30s or C40s, so just longer chains.
But in just looking at it, you may have no idea that paraffin oil and mineral oil are hydrocarbons from the petroleum industry. Right. You would never know. So unfortunately,
you have no idea.
We can't help you today with what you have on hand, okay?
Right.
Do not eat the fractionated coconut oil you bought. You could use it on your skin, but don't put it in your coffee or smoothie, okay?
No.
moving forward, make sure you buy ingredients from reputable sources and you just ask for a little documentation so you know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah, and you hope that documentation is accurate. I wouldn't have a lot of faith stuff I'm buying on the internet is necessarily going to be even accurate.
Except for me, Perry. Come on.
No. I'm not saying buying stuff on the internet is always bad. Like you say, you've got to have the first. You have to have trust in your source. So if you're buying something from someone you do not know at all, that's a bad step. So
if you trust them, that's a bad step.
Right.
That's a different
second step,
problem.
Right. Yeah. Have the right paperwork. And you should know that even big companies sometimes have a hard time with ingredients that are advertised as one thing and they turn out to not be that thing. And that's why we set up specifications. That's why you get a certificate of analysis and you still have a quality control group that runs tests on the ingredients that come in and everything's got to match up exactly. Yep. The hobbyist, maybe you're not doing that extra testing, and maybe a source will take advantage of that. And this is, I think, especially true when you have extract ingredients or plant-derived mm-hmm. ingredients, because you have no idea between the difference between if I'm buying a, I don't know, aloe vera extract or I'm just buying glycerin. You know, they could just, you wouldn't know the difference unless you're testing it.
Yeah. So if you are the hobbyist, super important that you know and trust your source for it and do not ingest any of that stuff.
Yes. Don't eat stuff from Craigslist. All right. We got time for one more there, Valerie.
Let's do it.
All right. This one comes to us from Taryn. Taryn inquires, do hair oils clog the scalp and slow down hair growth? Is there anything that we may use as a hair regime? Regimen? Regime. Jeez, I'm getting political again. I don't know. A hair regimen that would slow hair growth. For my clientele, the biggest thing is growth and hair moisture. Most of my clients are African American, and you have those with high porous texture who say their hair is dry, and some who have low porosity where the hair doesn't absorb anything, so it's always dry looking. I wish you guys could set up a lab for hair professionals like me to come and see the truth with our own eyes with different hair samples and products. Anyway, what's going on at the scientific level? I just want to be able to share that knowledge with my clients.
Yeah, great question, Taryn. So I would say I don't know any products that actually slow down hair growth. I do know that a couple ingredient suppliers have pushed extracts in the past that they say if you depilate some of your hair, like wax it off or waxing where you actually rip the whole hair follicle out or electrolysis, they have studies, I wouldn't say greatly conducted, where maybe like this cactus extract will slow down hair growth sure. from recurring, but I'm not aware of any actives that are detrimental of growth to hair on the head. I would say that most products stop hair growth because the hair is actually breaking off. It has nothing to do with growth out of the follicle, but your hair is fragile. And maybe it's from physical damage or chemical damage, but your hair is not able to grow because it continues to break. It's still growing. It just has the illusion of not growing.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of Diva Curl and Wen Conditioner people who might disagree with you. But
well, I think it has less to do with the ingredients and more to do with the methodology, right?
Of course, of course.
I mean, the biggest thing is you have to keep your scalp clean.
You
need to shampoo. You need to remove debris, especially if you're doing styling products and conditioning products and adding oils. If you weren't doing any of that, I would say maybe you could get away with not shampooing. I know a lot of people do the no poo method.
Right.
But those people also aren't using dry shampoos. They're not using conditioners. They're not using styling products. They're like no nothing to the hair.
And they don't mind having a greasy look. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would say if your guests are really concerned about have hair that's looking dry, they should use products that are designed for that texture that aren't lubricating. I would say in this case, less is more, meaning you want to do the least amount of things to your hair, but you want to care for the scalp and you want to lubricate the hair shaft so that it doesn't appear dry looking, but also that there is reduced breakage. And if you have someone who's high porous and low porous, maybe there are different products, but find the right product that works on both types of texture. So the high porous damage versus low damage, low porosity, they probably need different weights of things.
I must say, I've never embraced this classification of porousness. It's just to me, there's hair that's,
really?
Yeah, there's just hair that's damaged and hair that's not damaged. I mean, the porous.
Yeah, it's definitely a stylist term for sure. It's not a scientific term at all. It's definitely something that I would say is pretty valid from like a stylist perspective when you're seeing it on a guest, the hair's taking up tons of water.
Yes.
I think it's good rationale on that end.
Yes. And it's an easy way to talk about it. But to me, it's just like, it's damaged hair. It's not damaged hair. Like the hair coming out of your head is not like if you had no damage on your hair, there wouldn't be a porous and low porous and high porous. If there was never any damage.
Oh, correct. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, it definitely all comes from weather. Not necessarily, I mean, it is damaged because the hair is not in its native state, but it's definitely from weathering. It's, you know, getting the hair wet, being outside, being in the sun, being exposed to air, brushing it, putting stuff on it, being in pollution, smoking cigarettes. It's all that kind of stuff.
Getting your hair colored. Yes, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the worst. Yeah, perms is even worse than coloring for the hair.
It is.
But I wish we had a lab too, Perry. That would be so cool.
That would
if we
be
had
so
like
cool.
A little center in LA.
Wait.
I mean, but too bad we don't take money because
we don't run 100 commercials before the show even starts.
We don't run 5 minutes of ads at the beginning of the show, so we can't pay for this center. Unless I paid out of my own pocket.
Well, maybe someday someone's going to open up their own lab and, you know, we'll have some videos.
Wink.
Ah, boy, we talked the hell out of this show, didn't we, Valerie?
Yeah, what a great episode.
Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. You know, if you get a chance, go over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. Or at Spotify, you can leave us a review there, too. That's going to help other people find the show and ensure that we have a full docket of beauty questions. You know, Valerie, though, I was alerted to something today.
What?
You know, we are in the top 1% of listened to podcasts in the entire universe.
What? Well, no way!
That might be an exaggeration because I don't know. In other planets, there might be podcasts, but I'm just assuming that podcasts only exist here on Earth.
Basically, we're in the top 1%.
We are in the top 1%. Probably even higher, but hey, that's what we get for being the longest running beauty podcast there is with 233 episodes.
And anyway, guess what? I have an interesting fact for you. This week, we're going to hit our 10,000th follower on Instagram.
Oh, that's fun. Will you be number 10,000?
I hope so. So if you're wondering if you could be number 10,000, don't forget to follow us on our various social media accounts. On Instagram, we're at The Beauty Brains 2018. On Twitter, we're at The Beauty Brains. And we have a Facebook page.
And we're on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thebeautybrains and join your other Beauty Brains family and subscribe. That keeps the commercials out of the Beauty Brains episodes.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. And remember, be brainy about your beauty.
Thanks, everyone.